welcome to another episode of Radio Warner. The day today is April 13th, 2026, and this is episode 598. I am the co-host Mark Ames in Western New York State. You are listening to Radio Warner. Please subscribe and support the show. Go to patreon.com/Radio Warner and sign up. And I'm on the line, of course, with the Warner, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher in southern Italy. Well, not for long, I guess. John, how you doing?
Yeah, hi. Not for long is right. We're heading to bounce around Italy from Brindisi to the north, Turin. I don't know. I hate it. I hate any travel at this point. I've just had too much of it.
Yeah.
But it's probably a good idea.
Yeah. You traveled enough for about 10 lifetimes, I think, between 2015 and roughly 2023 or so. That would do it. Anyway, today we are going to discuss celestial warfare, really interesting battle going on right now between the Pope, the Catholic Church, and Trump. And I have to say, this battle was foretold, yay, by Annibale, our guest who is joining us today. So welcome back to Radio Warner, Annibale, and thanks for clarifying this or talking about this, because I think for a lot of people, especially not Radio Warner listeners in the English world, this was kind of a real shock out of the blue. Well, particularly Trump's, you know, as they say, broadside against the Pope of all people. But anyway, first of all, welcome back to the show.
Hi, guys. Thank you for having me back. It's always a good thing to be with you and talking about such interesting subjects. We're back in the Middle Ages, guys.
Yes,
I keep remembering Barbarossa walking around a castle in the middle of a medieval winter with bare feet as some kind of atonement to the Pope. And it would be really fun if Trump would do that. But I think he'd just fall over at the second step.
Yeah, probably. That was Henry IV. It was not Barbarossa. It was another Roman. But we're going to discuss about that, the Volcanossa thing and the struggle for the investiture controversy or struggle.
The Avignon papacy. Yeah, just real quickly for listeners, and I'll post this, but last year with Annibale, we did a show on, it was shortly after Pope Leo ascended, I guess you call it, became Pope. And so we did an episode, as episode 524, this was May of last year, to make sense both of what Pope Francis's papacy was really about, and then what Leo, what you thought the naming of Pope Leo, the first American Pope, with his humble background, what it meant. And I'm just going to sum it up very briefly, super briefly, and then you can expand on it, I know. But the big takeaway for me from our discussion of Pope Francis was that Francis was a reformer. I mean, I think people mostly focus on, is he liberal, at least in my country? Was he more liberal or was he more conservative, right? And that really wasn't the issue. I think his politics did align more with, I guess, what you would call on the left in this country. But that wasn't what it was about. It was about reform. It was about kind of re-centralizing power, gaining control of this massive, massive structure, potentially larger than any other political structure in the world, the Catholic Church, getting control of the finances, which had never been done before. And really centralizing so that the church could work more efficiently and streamlined, as they say in the business world, and naming Robert Prevost, Pope Leo, naming him, as you said, when it first happened, was a challenge. You said this is an interpretation. but you didn't challenge it necessarily, that this was kind of a challenge to this declining and dangerous American empire, not dissimilar to the naming of the Polish Pope John Paul II, was kind of seen as a challenge, or was a challenge, to the Soviet bloc back in this kind of second Cold War period. Does that sound roughly correct?
Yeah, it is. But there is something I want to start this episode with clarifying something, because I'm reading online all sort of weird stuff. I understand that a lot of people has a very sketchy idea how the church work, and in particular the history of the papacy in the last 1,000 years. But I must say also in the last 100 years. But there is one thing that needs to be absolutely clarified, is that neither Francis nor Leo are lefty, left-wing mm-hmm. types, woke mm-hmm. or Marxist or whatever. They're absolutely aligned with the tradition of the church social teaching since Leo XIII. And back at the end of the 19th century, is the same. They are in the same avenue. Also, they are. I see a lot of people say, "Oh, if John Paul II would be alive right now, he would support Trump." No, this is false. This is absolutely false. He actually he was very old and frail when the Iraq War started, but he absolutely opposed the Iraq War. And so while he was an anti-communist, he was definitely anti-Soviet, whatever you may think, he didn't roll back the whole thing, social teaching that the church has followed since Rerum Novarum, the encyclical that Leo XIII wrote at the end of the 19th century, setting up basically ending up two centuries of refusal, stern refusal by the church to embrace modernity, to understand modernity, and say, okay, modernity here, but the church has a role in modernity, and the church has a role following the teaching of the gospel, following the teachings of Jesus. So is need to be egalitarian without being, of course, socialist or communist or atheist. And that Francis and Leo are very much in line with that, okay? They are not telling anything new, but what they are doing new, and actually they're recovering a tradition of the church of the Middle Ages, is the language. They are speaking in as a pope of the 19th or early 20th century would have spoken. They speak and write as a Middle Ages, High Middle Ages Pope would have done. In case, I've seen people, for instance, you know, babbling about, this is just a repeat of the investiture controversy between Gregory the Seventh and the Emperor Henry the Fourth, the thing that we have discussed right now. Mm-hmm. And if you read the letter written by the Pope Gregory the Seventh, who was the Pope that culminated the reform that centralized the church and transformed the church into a political powerhouse in the 11th century, the so-called what were called Gregorian reforms. Right now the term is controversial, but they use it to be Gregorian reforms. He wrote this letter to the emperor, telling the emperor, your power, and the power, all secular power, and the power of kings, and the power of emperors, the power of dukes, is a power that derives from pagan institution, and is clearly, if it's not under the control of the church, under the control of Christianity, is corrupt by nature. Okay, mm-hmm. You are not emperor because you have been invested by God. you are emperor despite God. And so you need to submit yourself to the power of the church. The church is above all emperors, because without the power of the church, without the blessing of the church, without the blessing of the gospel of Christianity, all power is inherently corrupt. Is what Leo is saying is more or less the same thing, is that, you know, secular power by itself is corrupt, is the search for riches and the search for military power and imposing your will to the other through war is evil, is the work of the devil. Mm-hmm. Okay, but it's nothing new. It's just, you know, what the church has been telling again and again and again for the last 1,000 years. A lot of people, you know, you see sometimes on X or Facebook or whatever, people say, yes, but there were popes who fought in wars, there were popes who blessed armies and so on and so forth. In fact, if you check the historical record, the last pope who ever openly supported an aggression war was Innocent X in the middle of the 17th century. What, the last one? Every single pope from the middle of the 17th century until now has always condemned aggression, war of aggressions. Again, nothing new here, but the language is much stronger.
Yeah, and this is why the language is stronger, and also using social media makes it seem even more confrontational.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And this morning, when Trump went on, say, "I'm not a fan of Leo," and blah blah blah.
That's
whatever.
Putting it very nicely. I mean, I just read a little of it? And it begins this way, which is the This is like a guy who's only spent his life in like city politics or state politics or something. "Pope Leo is weak on crime." What? This is the first thing he says, as if like he's running for mayor against somebody whose first name is Pope and last name is Leo. "That liberal is weak on crime." That is the most nonsensical. You know, he talks about fear of the Trump administration, but doesn't mention the fear that the Catholic Church and all other Christian organizations had during COVID when they were arresting priests. Like, what? I
don't remember that at all, by the way.
No, actually, yeah. Nothing like that did happen.
There were some complaints or something, but it just, I like his brother Louis much better than I like him, because Louis is all MAGA. He gets it. And Louis does, and Leo doesn't.
Yeah, I don't know Louis, but the minute I saw that, I thought of, what was his name? Burt Young or whatever, Adrian's brother.
Oh, yeah.
Who like exudes sweat and cigars. Yeah. In
Fredo.
Rocky.
It's like Fredo. Yeah. Fredo is a good guy. Fredo is MAGA. Fredo from The Godfather. Yeah. It's and it just goes on, and he comes back to it. Unfortunately, Leo's weak on crime, weak on nuclear weapons, does not sit well with me. And he meets with Obama sympathizers. I don't know, maybe you're going to say something about the fact that he met with David Axelrod, who really was the main fixer for Obama. It was kind of interesting. He did that, I think. I mean, the Pope doesn't meet everybody. And then of course Trump posted on Truth Social an image of himself as Christ healing America.
Yeah, I'd really like to talk about that.
He took it down. He deleded it. I don't know if you saw this just in the last hour. So they deleted it.
Yeah, and
he said he thought he was just a doctor. That was me as a doctor.
Red Cross.
Red Cross. Which is pretty funny. I'll give him that. It's like the worst excuse.
Yeah, putting that glowing oil on, I don't know, John Stewart's face or whoever it was. Or some people are saying it's...
It's supposed Epstein, to be Uncle Sam. Right, it's Epstein. Yeah, it's supposed to be Uncle Sam, I thought. The hat and everything. I think that's what they said. And he's healing.
Shouldn't
Uncle
there be
Sam.
A more Jefferson Davis-y beard there?
I know. This, it didn't look like it. It's like young Jeff Davis. I don't know. Anyway, Anibale, I mean, again, I want to say you did say a year ago that there would be, this was a challenge. You essentially said there'd be confrontation.
Yes, yes.
And we're having it. And this isn't the first confrontation. So explain.
Well, that was, you know, it was a very easy prophecy because it's clear that the whole path of Bob Leo career before he became Leo was just a trajectory that seemed to be actually was funneled by Francis, you know, choosing this guy and grooming this guy in order to become a cardinal and then putting him into this kind of responsibility to make him, you know, getting trained for the job and then creating a staff. Because the whole thing, the staff he has on Parolin, Cardinal Parolin on one side and Pizzaballa on the other, is a dream team for many reasons, because it's just perfect, because you have Parolin with the moderate, you know, the diplomat, the consummate diplomat, the moderate, things that can actually create the situation to have, you know, to open channels in order to create discussion, you know, with different power bases around the world. And the other side, we had Pizzaballa, and Pizzaballa is a very charismatic figure, at the moment very unpopular with the Israeli government.
Could you remind us why?
Well, the first thing is because he has always been very confrontational. He's the patriarch of the Catholic patriarch of Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. He has always been very confrontational in terms of, particularly regarding the you know, the action of the Israel army and the police, both in Cisjordania and in Gaza. Mm-hmm. And also he always been very open, very vocal about the fact that there was a progressive disenfranchisement of Catholic, of Christians, in Jerusalem, the same way how there is being a disenfranchisement of Muslims. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very clear at the moment that the target of the Netanyahu government is to have Jerusalem as, oh, Jerusalem is just Jewish and every other religion, they're just guests until we decide they're not guests anymore. So he really denounced that. And everything came down to what did happen on the Palm Sunday, last Palm Sunday, when the war was with Iran was, you know, running since at the beginning of the month, and there have been missiles apparently falling very close to several churches in Jerusalem, and so with this excuse. The government decided to forbid any kind of public function on Palm Sunday. This is something that never happened since way, way, way back. And Pizzaballa declared he wanted to have a private, very private function inside the Saint Sepulchre church. And he was stopped before entering that. He was stopped by the police.
By the
Israeli police. Mm-hmm. And of course, everybody knows that Pizzaballa did that by purpose, you know. He did that because he wanted to be stopped, okay?
But I think most people, the laity, and again, we're talking 1.4 billion people, they just see the Israelis being brutal towards
Exactly. And of course, the first one who understood this was Netanyahu. Oh, no, backtracked, yes. You know, backtracked immediately. No, this has been a misunderstanding, just a misunderstanding. Because unlike Trump, he knows that he needs to have this kind, he cannot be so open in this confrontation. Even if in theory he could be, he has no qualms or no problem with Catholic voters, of course, you know.
I sort of have seen that. I have seen that in my own history of a roughly Catholic American background. The moment at which most American Catholics, it seems to me, prioritize their Catholic identity over other identities, other political identities, was long ago, like half a century. And they have managed, except in some ethnic Catholic communities, to imagine themselves at least in the American mainstream, and therefore they don't see any conflict with being a Trumpian, even though there is still a sniff of evangelical anti-Catholicism in the hardcore Trump ranks, or at least big sections of it.
Hegseth, yeah. Hegseth's pastor is a straight-up anti-Catholic bigot.
Yeah.
Is that Doug Wilson? Yeah.
So
do you think, John, that it, having an image like that would stir some kind of, wait a minute, I'm Catholic, you know?
I don't believe it anymore.
Okay.
Look, American politics is mostly gradations of rage and hate at the moment. And most of those people have rage and hate figures that they cherish the hatred of much more than anti-Catholics. In fact, I once sort of tried to be provocative in terms of
you.
I mean, not me face to face. God knows. But through various media, and Protestants just wouldn't take the bait.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would just say this though, and we'll get back to the Anibale's line here, but that I did see some very prominent voices, I don't know what you call them, on social media that I follow and I know of, who are Catholic, who were big supporters of Trump when he first came to office, who were already starting to break one way or another, and definitely the Iran war, like these are the kind of MAGA supporters that were really shocked and outraged by the Iran war and really started to like question. But then when they saw this, it was like they couldn't believe that they had ever supported somebody who would talk like that. They were really, it went from sort of you lied to me about the politics and about being anti-war and nationalism, you're just serving Israel, whatever, to actually personally offending me. And my own personal take on that was I was kind of surprised. These were intelligent people. I was surprised. It's like, how have you not been following Trump for the last 10 years? Like, his whole appeal is that he offends the shit out of demographics, and you cheer it and enjoy it, and it's funny for you because he doesn't turn on you, but eventually he turns on almost everybody. You know, he turns that on almost everybody. I mean, it was surprising to me that they would be so surprised that he would be so crude in the way he offended the Pope. But yeah, anyway.
Well, I think if you're mad enough at several groups, any group that you can name, you will accept some personal offense as collateral damage.
Yeah,
and
that's true.
You'll hope to survive it as long as their house down the street gets blown to bits.
It's interesting to note one thing. I was, listening to your comment. And today, after, Trump went on with that insane tirade, of course, you may know that Pope Leo, he went to Algeria today. And because he's the first step of a tour of Africa, he will do in the next few days. He's going in different countries. They're going to Cameroon. I don't remember the other. First is Algeria.
Well, the one is South Sudan, which has the fastest growing Catholic population in the world.
Right, okay. And Equatorial Guinea as well. Not the hugest populations, but I didn't realize. In Africa, there are, I think it was 285 million Catholics, and growing fast. But yeah, go ahead.
Okay. And it's interesting because when a pope flies somewhere, there are always journalists with them, not necessarily Vatican journalists, journalists from different outlets staying with them. And he normally does a press conference during the flight. And he was asked about Trump and whatever. And he said, and he came with a message that was clearly intended for an American audience. Because I say, right. I'm not a politician, and I don't want to enter. Actually, he was rolling his eyes when he's asked that. Right. He had this very sardonic smile with a hint of eyes rolling, like, oh, yes, whatever. And he say, I don't see my role as that of a politician. I'm not a politician. I don't want to enter into a debate with him, Trump. But I do not think the message of the gospel should be abused as some are doing. I will continue to speak strongly against war. I'm seeking to promote peace, et cetera, et cetera. There are too many people who are suffering today. Too many innocent lives have been lost. I believe someone must stand up and say that there is a better way. I say this to all world leaders, not only him, that means President Trump, and let us end wars and promote peace and reconciliation. I have no fear of the Trump administration, or I have no fear of speaking out loudly of the message of the gospel, which is what I believe I'm here to do and what the church is here to do. We are not politicians. We don't deal with foreign policy with the same perspective, in my understanding. He means Trump again, but I do believe in the message of the gospel as a peacemaker. I think this was really intended for the American audience, to say this. Yeah. This is not a political. Well, we are not doing a political debate with this guy. I'm here to, you know, as the Pope, because he was, of course, answering to Trump, saying, I'm here doing my job because I was overwhelmingly elected to do this job of bombing the hell out of nation across the earth, which, as you say before, Mark, is not true. A lot of people voted him to stop being the policeman of the world, so he did betray their confidence, their trust. And the Pope's answer was, well, you do your job. I'm doing my job, which is not doing politics in the same way you do. But there is always this veiled threat. Because what people don't understand is that, yes, a Pope cannot tell a president of whatever, king or leader, world leader, what he should do or not do. But he can speak to the conscience of religious conscience and the religious faith of the people who are under this leader, president, church, or whatever. And he can tell these people, okay, look at yourself and think if what you have been ordered to do is conforming to the message of the gospel. And just try to imagine, Pope Francis just did that at some point. But just imagine if Leo decide to use this kind of language that was used by Middle Ages popes to say, in case, for instance, Trump decide to launch an all-out war on Iran, say this war is against... if you look at yourself, you're going to see that this war is against the teaching of the church. And I maybe a lot of people will just ignore that, but a lot of people won't, okay? They must say, well, what I should do. It's not, I hope you understand, it's not the same thing as telling leaders what they should do or not do.
Yeah.
Is giving moral clarity at some point. The moral clarity regarding this issue is such and such. And this is a very powerful message, okay? I on X, I just tried at some point, I, I made this because someone asked me, what will Louis the 11th, the universal spider, you remember that,
mm-hmm.
the king mm-hmm. of France that Louis terminated that 100-year war, what he would say if he would be today here? And I say, probably would be sad, saying, what? I mean, 500 years are passed and people doing worse in terms of political mistakes.
Yeah, I think it would be something like a bunch of fucking amateurs.
Yes, exactly. It would say, doing a war without a clear strategy, being manipulated by a smaller ally, and getting into a war fight with the Pope. I mean, what the hell? I want to go back. I want to go back to my age. My age was more rational.
Yes,
you know.
Yeah.
And so, it's very funny. To some extent, it's very funny.
What I remember as a kid growing up in the middle of the Vatican reforms and the very beginning of the. Is in some senses the rival evangelical renaissance of the 70s was a sense of the Catholics, at first of being a kind of high esprit de corps and newly eligible for Americanism faction, to a vague sort of distaste and related to the fact that they sort of got integrated and they got sloppy. They didn't retain their cohesion. And after a while, they were frankly really nothing. And a lot of Protestant revivalists had much more power. And they were picking off converts. Especially that there was a convert from Catholicism to evangelical Protestantism who was infamous for declaring herself a witch or something. And that was a big faction. So I don't know how many American Catholics would follow the Pope. It would be touching if they did, but I don't think it's going to happen.
I think there is going to be a split. I'm not saying that it's going to be. I mean, mark my words. I think there is still maybe a minority, but it's going to be a very noisy minority. And the split risks to be very, very open. I think the tone and the strategy that's being used by Leo at the moment is very confident. Okay, he's very confident. If you look, very calm, very confident, very clear message, and fine-tuned for a certain type of audience. And I think that maybe the majority will not react, but there is going to be a very noisy minority that is going to follow his word. I strongly believe this.
I would say this. Look, a huge part of the Catholic Church here is the large and growing still, Hispanic population also. And you can't like say everybody is alike and so on, but just my own experience with friends of mine from that community and so on, that they would not like this. You know, they would feel kind of like, this is just not something you do. I'm talking about not liking Trump's personal assault on the Pope. Like, it would conjure up really weird feelings of guilt and something's wrong, something's not right, and you don't do this. I mean, these are the kind of things I saw on social
media.
That's
very true. I think that's across a bigger population. Roughly anybody who accepts American political ethics as they've evolved over the last century, like, there are things you don't do. You don't criticize anybody's church with about a million footnotes. You don't openly criticize their ethnic group. And it's more a matter of courtesy. And Trump breaking all those norms is just him stepping over a very scuffed line. But he's done that so many times.
But I think this is taken a little more personally. I don't know. I'm just, again, going by, you go by what you see and who you know. Mm-hmm. But I do think this particular assault is, it's not crossing a line of decor, which is generally disgusting and, oh, that disgusting Trump. But it's actually aimed at you, and maybe your parents take the Pope and Catholic Church more seriously, or your grandparents who are still alive, or something. So it feels a lot more like, wow, he's looking at me now the way he's talking about Somali immigrants, or the way he's talking about whoever he despises, trans people, I don't know, whoever he despises that day. And I think it's a little more.
Well, I did have one reaction, like an atavistic reaction that was very odd, and I think kind of significant, so I'll admit it, even though it's rather embarrassing. When Pezeshkian came out and defended the Pope, I was oddly touched. Yeah. And I thought of the relations between various Muslim rulers and their Christian subjects in many ways. It wasn't all a nice history, but parts of it were. And even a scene I remembered with the knights of a Christian order going to Alamut to negotiate with the assassins. And I thought, that's kind of cool.
I think there are two, referring to these, I think there are a couple of observations that need to be done. The first is an anecdote, but it's something that happened to me today. I was discussing this with a middle-aged Moroccan woman who works, she sells vegetables, groceries in a local market square. And I know her since way back. And she's Muslim, not particularly, I mean, she's not secular at all, but she thinks herself as a good Muslim. And she was incredibly offended by Trump, you know, disparaging the Pope, but the whole thing about Trump posing as as Jesus. She found that absolutely. Yeah. She was really upset, but really said this is, because of course you know that Jesus is a prophet, yes. And for Islam.
Well, I think that's something we have to discuss, but I think we got the sort of wrong end of the thing here, and the right end would seem to be that this is a deep, deep norm in American culture in general, in American movie culture, for example. There's real nervousness about whether you depict the current president, and there were many moves up till the 1970s to depict him only in profile or from behind or something, and that is intensified when it comes to Christ. And the idea that anyone, much less a degenerate like Trump, would put himself in a Christ costume, basically, a Christ Halloween costume, should be utter anathema to American born-agains, and it isn't. And that's, I think we should focus on that. That's kind of shocking.
But he did take down
the image. Yeah, he took it down.
He took down the image because apparently some of his religious followers were absolutely furious about him.
Yeah, it was too much.
And this was a red line that he did cross. The other thing it's interesting to note is that it's clear that Trump is trying to discuss with the Pope as he will do with, as you say that, Mark, beautifully before, as he will discuss with some liberal running up for major somewhere, for president.
Yeah.
It seems that he's not doesn't understand that he's not discussing with someone like this. It's a different role. It's a different image. You cannot use this kind of language because you don't look smart. You don't look funny. You look like a loser.
Yeah.
Which is the perfect image. The perfect image of this thing is someone babbling. Okay. Mm-hmm. And maybe, I mean, I don't doubt that it probably is not just something. I don't believe in the theory that is insane. I think that is just, he has some narcissistic trait or whatever, but I think that all this kind of campaign, you know, communication campaign is something where probably has professional helping with that. But and he probably decide like, this is very much something out of the Goebbels school of propaganda. The fact that you have a lot of professional helping you with that, but then in the end you decide. Okay, is the boss that decides what is the end message.
It and always has to be on brand, within his brand, and he's very, exactly. He's an entertainer. He's really good at it.
Exactly, but this kind of thing could have worked again against a lame liberal candidate for whatever, not someone as surgical and focused. A surgical and focused religious leader who has a very strong sense of his mission. So this was a huge communication fiasco. It is clear that there is a problem in communication regarding this. The last thing is, this, as we did discuss online in the last few days, Mark, this thing of the Pope stepping in so hardly into the communication arena in the world, stuck a nerve somewhere. Because I can say that for personal reason, because my post on X went from thousands of views to hundreds of thousands, even at some point millions of views. So it means like there is a circulation with people, you know, reposting furiously when I started to discuss this thing about the Pope.
Yes.
Okay. So there is a lot of international attention on that. The public at the moment is really interested in what is going on, which brings us to my fear. And my fear is that the temptation of both Trump or Netanyahu, if you know the whole thing with between Catholic Church and Netanyahu escalate more, is try to cut the conversation short and... you know, and accident can happen. You have seen the two suicide bombers in Algiers.
There hadn't been a suicide bomber since 2012, and they just happened to pop up today when he was heading out there. That's pretty remarkable. Yeah.
Okay. So I really hope at the moment that there is still a deep state in the U.S. preventing this, but I don't know.
Yeah,
you know better than me.
No, it's it's a real danger, and but I want to get back to something, and that's a thought that we're going to have to come back to because you had said, I don't know, maybe it was to me like maybe even a week or two ago, like basically I fear for something effective that, you know, your fear for Leo that something that the Trump administration, the Trump deep state, they're not going to just take it that they are going to, we're either going to have a new pedophilia scandal
or something
about his, you know, I mean, this is not it, you know, of course, but like his Nazi past or, you know, it's not going to happen with him, but something along those lines or, you know, a lone nut does something to him. But we're also here, you know, let's not forget what also just came out over the last week or so, which is that, the Pope's representatives in America had meetings with the Pentagon people, right? And the Pentagon is run by Pete Hegseth, who among his many problems is, as I said, his pastor is a loon is an anti-Catholic bigot. These are the wing of evangelical or Protestantism it's an old wing that sees Catholicism as, you know, idol worshiping, pagan worshiping, or something. He's kind of from that area. But anyway, that they They said initially that it was Elbridge Colby, which was surprising to me. It didn't sound like what I've read about Colby, that he's the one that basically threatened the church to support Trump and support what they're doing and keep your mouth shut. It was a real mafia kind of sit down.
Yeah, but see, I mean, I have to disagree in this way with, I guess, both of you, that I think in Eldridge Colby's generation, say, elite Catholics identified so well with the American interest and often with very conservative parts of the American interest that I don't think it's really even, and I say this kind of sadly, I don't think it's really even very difficult for them to decide whether they're going to identify with the church or with Trump. If they've chosen Trump, they're going to stick with that.
Yeah, no, that I mean, I was kind of thinking that too. It's just that it's something that could go on his record, and that's the only thing that would kind of surprise me. But when people get into power like that, they'll do anything to get there, and they'll do anything to stay there.
Yeah.
And if that was the sort of job given to him, because he comes from a well-known Catholic family, you know, his dad was the CIA head many years ago, then yeah, you're right, John. I mean, it's believable. It was just kind of surprising to see that. But what's come out since then are a whole bunch of follow-up reports, either confirming it or trying to say that this is massively exaggerated, or at least that's what Trump people are saying. But from what if you read between the lines, it's pretty clear something along these lines happened. And I want to know from Italy, Annibale, what you may have heard about this meeting and
it did happen. Yeah.
Okay.
It did happen. No, this did happen, actually.
As it's been reported.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It did happen as it's been reported. The meeting was clearly not a good meeting. The whole thing about the Avignon story, and we're going to explain very briefly what Avignon the papacy in Avignon really was in a minute, but the whole thing may have been told in jokingly, semi-jokingly term, but it's clear the meeting was not a good meeting. Apparently, what I've heard is that the part that is really true is that there was some kind of pressure in trying to understand if Pope Leo could be amenable to support war against Iran, mm-hmm. okay, under the pretense of, but it's a war to avoid Iran having the nuclear bomb weapons. And so on, blah, 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 because Iran bad. And of course, the nuncio papale, the ambassador of the Vatican, told us, we are not on the side of anybody, and definitely it's so. Actually, this kind of pressure failed, and this was considered by some of the insider. This was considered the moment where Trump thought that Leo was a lost cause, because initially it appears that. The rumors are that initially Trump was really seeing Leo as a break from Francis, like more, a softer, more soft on several things, less vocal, less open on particularly on things like the Levant, the Middle East, more focused on Ukraine and blah, 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 blah. But it's clear, it's now clear that this was not true. Simply, Leo was just getting more and more energy, getting ready for the confrontation when the confrontation will have begun. It's interesting, of course, that the fact that this did happen and was revealed in a moment where our Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni is getting weaker by the day following her defeat in the referendum on the career path of the judges in last month.
I'm sorry, I just have to interject because you had said, we won't get into the details of it, but you said this judicial reform that Maloney tried to push through a referendum was initially proposed by Luciagalli?
Luciagalli,
the infamous P2, basically the face of Years of Lead that a lot of people identify with the Years of Lead.
Exactly. Yeah. And the reform by itself is not in particularly weird. They just having to separate career path for prosecutors and judges. But in the Italian context, this was widely seen by an attempt of a right-wing government to give a rein, you know, put
to remove a check on their power.
And this was perceived by a lot of people as something like that. And so the victory of the opposition to this reform was overwhelming and politically very inconvenient for Meloni. That was, you know, you under this aura of invincibility, mm-hmm. the first normal prime minister in Italy since way back, she has put Italy back in the international table and blah, 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 blah. At the moment, she's very weak on that. And she's mishandled this papal crisis quite badly because initially, she was really in Trump pockets, saying, "Oh, our friend is America. We're friends with Trump." But then the war started, and the war is very unpopular in Italy, incredibly unpopular. And she started to say, "We are neither against nor for the war," which is this kind of nonsense that a lot of people find absolutely grating, you know.
Yeah.
It's really
cringy.
That's
why they hate the woke liberal types for that kind of language. She's supposed to tell it like it is.
And
right?
And when to this morning the whole Trump versus the Pope thing exploded, she refused until 20 minutes ago to do a direct condemnation. And now, finally, she did that just 20 minutes ago. She said, "Oh, I have been misunderstood. I think this kind of attack is crazy, is wrong. The Pope must speak against the war." So she did an open condemnation, but just after everybody else in Italy, even the mayor of Rome was very open, saying this is nonsense. Trump cannot attack the Pope like this, because everybody knows that, you know, at the moment, not standing with the Pope in Italy will kill your political career. Right now, at the moment, as things are standing, if you fail to defend the Pope, if you fail to say the Pope is right, your political career is over, okay? Because he's very popular. He's a very popular Pope, okay? He took some times for him to become popular. Initially, a lot of people were suspicious about his motives, but since last couple of months, particularly since last month, his popularity has skyrocketed. Okay. It's interesting.
Wouldn't you say, we talked about this with Francis last year, but I think because of being more confrontational and having, you know, as they say, moral clarity and not shying away from it, but being clear about this, that is helping stem the bleeding from the church, I think. I mean, it's what you want from your religious leaders, I think.
Exactly.
Something like this.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You need to have more moral clarity.
Yeah.
This kind of moral clarity. And you cannot. The Trump mistake is that you can joke with everything, and be rude and horrible about anything, but not this kind of things, because people right now is really looking for more clarity, because there is none anywhere. I think that part of the reason for the survival, whatever you may think about the Iran government right now, it's clear that a lot of people in Iran right now thinks they have some kind of moral clarity in standing for Iran. They are not just standing for their roles, as leaders, but they're standing for something else. Okay.
Well, I mean, somebody had to stand up to the U.S. in an effective way, and whether that's to the credit of Iran's reigning deity or what, or whether it's a matter of simple geography in some ways, but Iran has stood up to the U.S. And when a U.S. proxy, Adamo, when the U.S. proxy was doing some particularly grim stuff, and they took a kind of ritual revenge on that. So it would be very appealing.
Well, and also I think maybe Anibale is kind of alluding to this, that the Trump people, the Trump world, and Trump himself especially, are very deliberately being Darwinistic, amoral, might makes right. I mean, this is kind of, gloves off, no mercy, no quarter. This is their sort of their religion right now. And it's
pretty unappealing. They do it very badly. Like Hegseth, with his beady-eyed little South Park expression, trying to do mafia menace is just embarrassing.
Exactly. It's the cult of badassery, call it. This cult of badassery that is something that you take out from movies. It's, this is such badass. It's so badass. This is such badass. And so on and so forth. And people don't understand that this kind of thing normally never happens in real world. Yeah. I tell you that by experience, okay? Yeah. I cannot be more specific. But remember, normally, there are a few real badass people, but they tend to be badass just in very specific moment where it is necessary, and normally you don't display. Sometimes you have more power where you don't display it too much.
Right.
Okay.
It reminded me, Mark, of that scene you always admired in the late David Lynch film Lost Highway, where the mob boss, L.A. style mob boss, with a really cheery manner. Mm-hmm. When he gets very jealous, like lethally jealous of the young hero, he doesn't threaten at all. He just puts his arm around him and is like, "How you doing, Pete? How's things?"
Yeah, yeah. And there's that time when he calls Pete up and he's with the devil, Robert Blake. He's like, "How you doing, Pete? You doing good?" And somebody wants to talk to you. And the devil says, "How you doing, Pete?" or whatever, and hands the phone back to Goulet. And Goulet says, "I just want to make sure you're feeling good."
Yeah.
But it is interesting to note, I think that you were right before, Mark, saying that this kind of cult of religion of badassery is horrible. Particularly, it's horrible when you don't win.
Yeah.
Because until you win, or until you see yourself part of a narrative of triumph, like in the movies, the good badass in the movies always triumph at the end, okay? And is considered liberating at some point, because there is this triumph of the good people for a just cause at the end. But this is just normally in movies. In real life, what you see is just horror. Killing people, murdering people, betraying people, this kind of thing. And when this narrative doesn't bring you to the ultimate triumph, to look cool and like the winner, but just in this kind of confusion, in saying one thing one day and then the reverse of that the next day, or just, closing the closure of the closing of the closure of the closure of the Hormuz Strait And it's people get it's, really.
It is tiresome. It is. Yeah. It's the whipsaw is tiresome. It's off-putting increasingly over time, and you just realize you're being whipsawed by some narcissist freak who has a lot of power and money and is having a blast doing it, and you're not. You're not one of the winners in this. We haven't even mentioned it, because it's almost irrelevant, I guess. But just in the last 24 hours, Trump announced that he's going to close the Strait of Hormuz. He's going to do Iran's job and close the Strait of Hormuz. And then he announced, this morning it's closed. And then he announced, we're really close to a deal. I mean, it's the same shit for, 8 weeks now, whatever, 7 weeks. It's the same shit. Within a day, just an endless whipsaw. It's the whipsaw that goes on in his head that charms people for a while. But God, it gets tiresome.
Yeah, I have to say to that, am I the only one here who was really surprised at the non-reaction for the Trump fan base? I mean, most of them, aside from Marjorie Taylor Greene, who, by the way, is becoming very interesting.
Yeah,
I mean, the one whom the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. But she objected to being lied to and told that Trump was going to be a pacifist. But that reaction has been very rare, and I find that creepy.
There have been, Trump called them out. Actually, he attacked the apostates, I guess it would be the Trump, ex-Trump apostates by name. Tucker Carlson, of course, Candace Owens, Marjorie Taylor Greene, but he called her like Marjorie Traitor Brown. I know.
That'll fix her.
Yeah, that'll fix her. But they do command large audiences. He really went after them. It was like the way he went after the Pope. But it was more, it was even just more sort of childish and scathing, calling them losers and so on. And there was even a hint there, at least from his orbit of influencers, that he might send the FBI or DOJ to investigate them. These podcasters for supposedly, taking money from Qatar or somehow being in league with Iran or the Muslim Brotherhood or some shit like this. But in terms of 95% of them that crowd stuck with Trump. He has bled some support. Like, support for the war was very high at first among MAGA people. It's a very unpopular war. I don't think there's ever been a war this unpopular this early. But over the course of the month, especially as gas prices were going up and Trump just kept whipsawing everybody, his numbers with MAGA went down by a good 10% or so. And there was this other poll that Israel is unpopular even with under 50 Republicans now. I mean, it's really unpopular among Democrats, especially the younger ones, but even older ones. But Israel's only base now are over 50 Republicans. And that's probably who's sticking with Trump in this war more than anything.
Right, right. Yeah.
It's interesting, just speaking about very recent news, that Leo is using this trip to Africa to make some interesting remark. The one that's been said, I think, 30 minutes ago, he made something like a speech based on the fact that the society the society in Africa need to be based on principle of justice and solidarity. And then went on in a remark to say, today this is more urgent than ever in face of continuous violation of international law and neo-colonial tendencies.
Wow.
I was going to ask you, what did the Italian church have to say about the invasion of Ethiopia when it took place?
Oh, they were completely against. Mm. Absolutely.
Oh, good.
Absolutely. Okay. No, no, absolutely, absolutely. No, this has been particularly the Abyssinia War in at the end of the 19th century was absolutely, completely, fully condemned by the Catholic Church. There were people, referring to this as the work of the devil in sermons. But this was because, of course, the first Ethiopian War, the first Abyssinian War, the one that ended up with the Battle of Adwa, was something that had been organized by the Italian government in a moment where the Italian government was profoundly anti-clerical, anti-Catholic. Was one of the moments where it was most secular from this point of view. And this was after Rome had been conquered in 1870. And so there was an enormous split between the Italian government and the church. And the one of the reasons why the Catholic Church didn't like the colonial the attempt to conquer Abyssinia was that it was perceived as a Christian country. Mm-hmm. So say you are not supposed to. This was actually it was a surprising big deal because they are Christian, they are old Christian, and by the way, this kind of old Christian churches in the East or in Africa, this was the moment where the huge rift that had opened between Western and Eastern churches over the centuries was beginning to heal to some point because there were, you know, there starting to be links that were ties. And also the entire the work of missionary work in Ethiopia was profoundly different than the missionary work that has been done anywhere else in Africa, because fundamentally Ethiopia was perceived as a mostly as a Christian country. Of course, you know, there were a lot of Muslims there, but it was the idea that the Ethiopian church was considered the underdog in this sense. Okay, so there was, when Adwa, when the Battle of Adwa was fought and Italy lost, the reaction of the church was, yes, you see, you have been struck by God, you were doing the work of the devil. So it was really unpopular.
Wow.
Really, really,
interesting.
Really. And it was also at some point became also unpopular, of course, with the population, because there was a you ended up in the Italian army as a conscript for a couple of years or even more, but you could, rich people or people with some money could right. buy their way out of this, paying someone else to go to the war in their place. And so this made the whole thing really unpopular, seeing really unjust. So Mussolini winning in 1935, relatively quickly, added some of his mystique, because the whole Abyssinia War had been widely seen as a disaster, something horrible that had to be forgotten, okay? And
the Vietnam War.
Anibale,
let me ask you about something talk about this a bit. One of your tweets, I thought this was really fascinating. I think a lot of people did too. Just to quote the second part of it here, I mean, it's of course referring to everything we're talking about today. For those still asking Stalin's tired and almost certainly apocryphal question about how many divisions the Pope has, in 2026, in a fully interconnected world commanding 1.4 billion people's attention and framing moral reality across every platform, is not a soft alternative to hard power. It is hard power. And I want to ask you about that, and as a subset to that, is emphasizing the Gospels part of that, or maybe it's always been the exact same thing. You've kind of said that as well, because from my point of view as an outsider, as somebody went back and read the Bibles, you know, we've talked about it on the show, and who's spent a lot of time, you know, with Protestants and Pentecostals who went to a really dull Episcopalian school and chapels for a few years when I was younger. I went to Catholic churches a lot because all my friends were Catholic where I grew up. The Gospels are very, I have to say, it kind of shocked me when I read them at age 35, like really read them as to read them. And they're very radical. And I just noticed, and I talked about this, I think, with John, that the Protestants don't talk about the Gospels much. And the Episcopalians, the Episcopalians would allude to them in the most sanitized way, the most bland, sanitized way imaginable. When you read them in the raw, if you read them all, like, you know, the way I was like really getting into trying to read these books, it was very radical. And I think they're not talked about much for a reason. Like when you hear people calling Leo or Francis, you know, a commie, it's kind of because, I mean, this is a cliche, but it's true. It's kind of because Jesus was kind of a commie.
I told you before. I mean, again, the Christian church, the Catholic church, always been basically egalitarian because the gospel is egalitarian. You see a lot of people just like say, no, that you need to take the Old Testament in account. In the Old Testament, there is all this crazy stuff about exterminating your neighbors and blah, 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 blah. But the point is this, I mean, the Bible is both the Old and the New Testament, but the New Testament is radically different. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Radically different. Yes. Everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. It's radically different. And the Catholic Church has always used both the Old Testament and New Testament, always saying that the focus needs to be on the New Testament. Mm-hmm. You have, during the Mass, you have the reading of something, maybe some of the Psalms or whatever, right. But it's always something from the Gospels, for Gospels. Because this is where the message is Christian, is Jesus Christ, you know? And you need, if you think yourself as a Christian, you need to read the word of Christ, not just what went before and conveniently forget and see, oh no, I want to demonstrate the historical reality of the Genesis, but then I forgot completely about what is written inside John, Mark, Luke, and Matthew. What you read inside that message that you have inside that is the center, it should be the center of the Christian reality, the Christian thinking. And remember so that the four Gospels are the four official Gospels, because you may know that there are, the other Gospels that are not recognized by the Church. But the four Gospels are very different one from the other in terms of character. Luke, for instance, Luke is more focused on the idea of Christ as the source of goodness, the source of misericordia. I don't know what is the misericordia. I don't know what is the empathy or things like that. While John is more the idea of high-minded, almost prophet-like Jesus and so on and so forth. So they need to be read all together. But they are radical. And I think this is a cliché, it's a complete cliché, but no, you know, Pasolini did understand that when he did the movie The Gospel According to Matthew. Mm-hmm. Okay, when he openly portrayed Jesus as a revolutionary. By the way, Jesus as a black, dark skinned or non-blonde, non-Aryan,
blue-eyed,
revolutionary. And again, I want make no mistake. I'm not saying, because I've seen saw a lot of people saying nonsense about the theology of liberation, say, no, but well, Leo is supporting the theology of liberation and so on and so forth. No, theology of liberation was something very specific. It was an attempt to try to align Christian and Catholic sensibilities with revolutionary sensibility is something completely different. It's not even left wing. Mm-hmm. Okay, it can be interpreted as that, but it's just what the gospel says. It's as easy as that. And I find insane that people could think that someone who is really serious about the gospel can believe into aggression and war to conduct political discussions. This is nonsense. And I mean,
is it part of what helps create the hard power, and part of what, you know, what creates, I don't know, the what organizes 1.4 billion people is the power, the radicalness of the gospels. Would you say it or not?
Yeah, in order to be a leader, to project leadership, you need to have some kind of philosophy. Let's call it philosophy, okay? Maybe a religion, an ideology, something that need to be clear, focused, and easy to understand, and that creates the perspective of hope of a better world. You cannot rule saying, I'm ruling just trying to create the worst possible, or I'm just trying to rule for today. That today is going to be great and tomorrow, who cares? You cannot do that. This is not real leadership. And the kind of leadership...
But I think of the many compromises that were made rather awkwardly, because the teachings are pretty absolute. But I think of Bishop Odo at the Battle of Hastings going around smiting Saxons with a club because edged weapons were not appropriate for clergy.
I mean, that was the Middle Ages. It was an age where you could kill people. You were committing a sin, definitely. You will have to respond to God for that. But, you know, other sins were considered probably even worse, like theft, okay? Mm-hmm. Theft during the Middle Ages was considered much worse than murder. Particularly murder if you had a reason to murder someone. And being through a battle was definitely having a reason to do it. It's just later on that the this kind of violence was started to be considered a crime in the sense that we consider right now. So... yeah, there were changes, but if you check the history of the church, you will see that the majority of the great thing, the famous thinker in the church, and the important popes were very. There was a line of thought that was always very coherent with this idea of a world that need to be more just, and then a world that need to be more peaceful. Okay. And of course, there were, you know, like the position of the church over slavery is an interesting point from this point of view, because there were a lot of up and downs. But there was the character the church had over the years was surprisingly well focused into the teaching of the gospel. And this is the reason why the church has a survivor for 2,000 years. It's not because, well, someone could say it's because of the providence, the divine providence. There is people right now, even non-religious people right now in Italy, who start to think, well, maybe this thing about the divine providence deciding who is going to be the pope is true, because at this point, having an American pope is our last line of defense against the madness of the world. Mm-hmm. And because if the pope had been South American or European, the conversation would have been much more difficult from this point of view.
Yeah, it's true. It would have made it much harder for Trump to pay attention to it. And
yeah, at the moment he's forced to pay. At this point, he's forced to pay attention. But I mean, I want to end this episode the same way it did begin. there is probably in the way the dealings are made and, you know, conversation are held between, you know, world leaders like Trump, particularly like Trump and the church, is very much informed or non-informed by the lack of understanding of the history of the church. And the whole thing about Avignon is a clear sense that people is just mentioning stuff they half remember for whatever reason from pop history, and they never took the pain to open a book and try to read about them. Because Avignon, the whole Avignon thing was the conflict started between King, French King Philip the Fair, and the Pope Boniface the Eighth. Of course, the problem was that Philip the Fair wanted to have a lot of more money, wanted to suppress certain orders, like the Templars, and wanted to have the Pope to help him, and wanted also to decide who was going to be the next Pope. And there was this conflict, and in the end, Philip the Fair won, Boniface died, and the next few popes were all French and were not in Rome anymore, but they were staying in a French city called Avignon under nominal protection, but really control from the French court. This is the story everybody remembers. In reality, what did happen was a bit more complicated, and in particular, it's interesting. The outcome is interesting if you see it from the point of view of someone like Trump. Because what did happen is that, yes, Philip the Fair won this duel with Boniface VIII, but he won it just because he enlisted the help of several powerful Roman families who did hate Boniface, okay? And so it was an inside job more than anything else. And then the next Pope, Clement...
Regime change.
Regime change. The next Pope, Clement V, was much more, you know, softer toward the king. But what did happen is that in 1 year, as the famous says, the famous story of the curse of the Templars, the last Grand Master of the Templar Order, cursing the Pope, the King, and the Philippe Guillaume Nogaret, the minister of the King, from while he was going to be burnt at the stake, and then all three dying in 1 year, and actually, so Philippe died, and then. For the French kingdom, it became one catastrophe after
the
other.
Absolutely. Go see our 100 Years War series with Annibale from here, because France goes to absolute hell.
Absolute hell. Yeah. Okay, absolute hell. Not only the
dynasty. That's why I thought it was so weird they're bringing up Avignon. Yeah. Like, okay, you're seeing America descending into complete hell and chaos.
But they even did a great series of books, absolutely, that you need to read, that is the Accursed Kings, Maurice Druon, Le Roi Maudit. There is even two miniseries.
It eventually got me down, which takes some doing. I mean, they're I've good read books, a lot though. Of gloomy stuff.
Yeah. No, so it's not a story of the triumph of the French king. It's the story of a French king doing something, and then France literally going to hell. Okay, for 100 years. And in the end, by the way, it's true that for some times there was this kind of political control over the papacy, but then this political control meant nothing, because at some point the Pope did not return to did not stay in Avignon because they were forced to, but because Rome was such a mess. Rome was an incredibly violent place in the middle of the 14th century, that it was probably better for them to stay in Avignon and the return where things were going to be safer. It was a choice. It was not right. They were prisoners there. So, you know, no, it's not the kind of things that Trump or everybody for, you know, whoever it is for Trump, he's trying to sell you. It was a
slightly
different.
It's called badassed in ignorance. Instead exactly. of virtuous ignorance, we have badassed ignorance, you know, and that's
precisely. Yeah, precisely.
That's a prerequisite to being a MAGA dumbass.
And I want to say that Avignon on the day we visited was one of the hottest places in the world. And I personally object to that.
Yeah, it's hot in Provence, and what, you were there in the midsummer?
Yeah.
July or August, yeah, it can be brutal. It's a pretty city. It is beautiful down there. I was there once ages ago, but hot and humid, yeah.
Yeah.
I think, Anibale, was there anything else you wanted to say? Because I think there's been a great discussion about this.
I mean, you have another couple of hours.
I know, what a silly question.
I was going to spend a good hour on, like, the iconography of this crazy painting.
Yeah.
It's worth some time, but not now.
AI generated image, yeah, that was taken down. And I do think what is so interesting and relevant is that he actually took it. Trump doesn't delete his genius sayings or images. And it shows that that even he has a line that he can't cross.
Well, but, you know, if you see the center top of the painting, it seems mm-hmm. to be Statue of Liberty with wings and something like horns coming out of its head.
Some demon.
There is a meme going around among Warhammer 40K fandom that is Sanguinus, one of the son of the Emperor, okay, one of the Primarchs of the Space Marines that is coming down on Trump. Sanguinus is wow. it. Sanguinius.
I gotta see
it
that.
You.
That's great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, on that cheerful note, I think we can end this episode.
Hail, what's his name?
Yes, Sanguinius.
Sanguinius.
All right. Well, thank you again so much, Anibale, for coming on and talking about the spiritual warfare going on right now.
Yeah.
You know, we have plenty more to discuss with you. Of course, we have to. We will get back to our Barbarossa series very soon.
Oh, of course.
I'm sure everyone is asking about that. And
looking forward to that.
Yes. Okay. Right. We are too. All right. Thanks again. Thank you, Anibale, okay. John, Brendan, and everyone. And talk to you
soon. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye.